Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Paruta te sangamata sadvara ye sotavanto pamanchantu sadhanti. So this evening I'd like to speak a little bit about breath meditation. Breath meditation being probably in Buddhism the most popular form of meditation. Something that's very simple, very pure. We know that this was the Buddha's own favorite meditation. He practiced under the Bodhi tree. And if we look at the teachings of most of the great monks, we see that they also recommend and praise breath meditation very highly. It was interesting speaking with Ajahn Anand one time, and one of the monks asked about doing kasina meditation because they'd been told they'd got special inside information that they'd done a certain kasina in their past life, and they thought, whoopee, I can get a fast track to nirvana. And Ajahn Anand said, well, you know, that actually all the monks that he knows who's got anywhere in the practice, they use breath meditation and body contemplation. And these were the meditations which really were very powerful. So when we do breath meditation, we're in a sense doing something which is quite excessively ordinary, something which is so normal you wouldn't notice it. Something which is just part of our bodies, part of our lives, every day, every moment. Become so mundane, so pervasive that we simply don't notice it, we don't see it. So if we're asking like why we're doing that breath meditation, it's because that seeing this thing that's so ordinary, that's so overwhelmingly mundane, when we see that transform, when we see that change, when we see that become something special, something unique, something radiant, then we begin to understand what is the power of the mind. We begin to understand what is the power of being able to change the nature of awareness. Not to just change, you know, what you're aware of, but to change how awareness is. And so if we choose in many religions and in Buddhism as well, sometimes they choose meditation objects that are very like exalted in themselves, like we might do recollection of the Buddha, just like in say Hinduism or something, they might, you know, recollect Krishna or something like that, and by recollecting something which is already very exalted and extraordinary, and then you make your mind exalted and extraordinary. But when we're doing breath meditation, we're recollecting something that's not exalted, it's not extraordinary, it's something that's very, very ordinary. And that's why it's such a special meditation. One of the things that we learn as we do breath meditation is how intrinsically our breath is intertwined and interconnected with our body, with the energies in our body. And this is not an esoteric or speculative theory, this is just an experience, a very normal experience. And so to do breath meditation, we sit down in a quiet place, a place that's free of distractions. Make the body comfortable, but alert, not too relaxed and not too tense. When we first come to meditate, spend a good bit of time simply just settling into your body. Don't be in too much of a rush. If you need to adjust the posture at the beginning, then do so. Settle in until you feel reasonably comfortable. But then you have to reflect. It's just like this. It's not going to be completely comfortable. It's not going to be perfect. I've known people who were expert yogis who practiced yoga for many, many years and could do, you know, very advanced postures, and still they would complain of having pains and so on and difficulties when they were sitting. So this is something which is just inherent in the body. If we're going to do this crazy thing of meditation, just sitting there and not moving for long periods of time, then we're going to experience pain, we're going to experience discomfort. So get used to it. Notice that as your body becomes settled and at ease, the coarser energies in the body are stilled, and the breath starts to become apparent. So it's good to wait until that stage before you start watching the breath. That means that you don't just sit there and then, like, you're in, you know, in the middle of all the stuff happening in your body, and then you're trying to find the breath in the middle of all that stuff. And it's like if you've got to meet somebody in a busy train station and you've got to sort of find somebody in the middle of all those people there. That's not the best way to look for the breath. It's much better if you're just patient, as if you had to meet somebody in the train station and then you just waited patiently, and then everybody else was gradually leaving, and then the person you had to meet was the only one staying there, the only one left behind. That's the right way to look at the breath. Just to sit there quietly, let the other stuff drop away, and then, oh, there's the breath. Very clear. Make sure when you're doing breath meditation, be very clear about what you're doing. Be very decisive. Don't just drift around from one meditation to the other. Don't just be thinking, I'm going to be doing breath meditation, and then you end up doing something else, or just thinking about this and that, and then, oh, half an hour later, you realize you're supposed to be on the breath. Be very firm. Be very decisive. Now's my time for doing breath meditation. Not my time for doing anything else. I'm going to watch the breath and nothing else. I'm going to watch the breath and nothing else. I'm going to watch the breath and nothing else. Tell yourself that when you start the meditation. Repeat it 3 times. Now I'm going to watch the breath and nothing else. Make it very firm, very definite in your mind. Then when it comes time to watch the breath, watch it. First of all, you watch it wherever it feels clear. So don't worry about where it is, whether it's in the belly or the chest or the nose or whatever. Just wherever you feel it, that's clear. Most of the time, for most people, it's at the nose, the end of the nose and the nostrils. It doesn't really matter. The main thing is that that sensation is like quite definite, quite defined. And you want to watch, I mean, it sounds like sort of, sounds like a kind of ridiculous, stating the obvious, but you want to watch the airiness of the breath. You know, feel the breath as air, as this flow of air, something that's very light. And that will give a lightness to the mind. So the first thing you do is just still the body and mind for a good period of time, maybe 10, 20 minutes, maybe longer if you need to, before you start watching until all the body energies are tranquilized enough. Start watching the breath when it's clear, the air coming in, air going out, and be definite about it. You should try to catch the breath each time the breath comes in and each time the breath goes out. Now, when you're starting your meditation, then of course the mind's still moving. You don't expect your mind to not be moving at this stage. Of course it is. Of course you start thinking about things. It's the nature of the mind. So don't worry about this. Don't concern yourself with it. Just keep on bringing the mind back to that breath. And so this bringing the mind back, or lifting the mind onto the breath, this is the jhana factor we call vitakka. It's a continual reapplying. And there's some effort there. When we're starting, when we're at this early stage, we put an effort into each time the breath comes in. We put an effort each time the breath goes out. We're not lazy. We don't just drift along some kind of vague, woofly idea of the breath, thinking we're going to go into dreamy nana land and everything's going to be bougie, gougie, gougie like marshmallows. This is not proper breath meditation. This won't get you to samadhi. You need to apply yourself to that breath. You need to put effort in each time the breath comes in, each time the breath goes out. So you're continually reapplying, pinning the mind onto the breath. Just like children play pin the tail on the donkey. You've got to pin the mind onto the breath. But of course, every time you stick the pin in, it falls off. So you've got to do it again and again and again. So of course, this effort then of course needs to be balanced. If it's just a forceful effort, if it's like, you know, the brows sort of clenched and the nose screwed up and the eyes crossed, and then you're trying to watch the breath like that, then of course you're going to develop the medical condition known as samadhi headache. So this isn't the kind of effort which is we're talking about. It's a balanced effort. It's like an easeful effort, but a consistent one. So that the most important quality is not how much you're trying, it's not how much you're forcing or anything. The most important quality is how persistent is that effort. There's this sense of ease, this sense of rightness when the effort is flowing well. This sense that, yeah, this is how it's going, this is what's happening. And when it's like that, when it hits that spot, then things will go very smoothly. So as you're lifting the mind onto the breath, again and again and again, the breath coming in, you lift the mind on, the breath going out, lift the mind on, keeping on going, keeping on going. You'll notice that when you first start doing that, that the breath is relatively long. It's because the body still needs some oxygen, more oxygen, and is breathing more to bring in the oxygen. And also your brain needs oxygen. Your brain uses most oxygen of any organ in your body. So as your body calms down and as your brain calms down, you're not thinking so much, then you don't need so much oxygen. And it's just a very simple physiological thing. And so because of that, the breath becomes more and more subtle. And this is what it's talking about in Anapanasati, in the Sutta, in the 16 steps. The first is watching the long breath and then watching the short breath. Doesn't mean that you deliberately sit there and say, oh, that's the long breath, okay, and now go, and it's a short breath, and then you think, oh, that's Anapanasati. That's not what it's talking about. It's not like making yourself breathe long and making yourself breathe short. It's just watching that natural process unfolding. So these steps in Anapanasati, they're not things that you do, but they're signposts so that you can recognize how the meditation's unfolding. So you watch that breath, each breath coming in, each breath going out. Keep on lifting your mind onto that breath. Use that effort longer than you think you need to. One of the things that always comes up in meditation is there's this mara of laziness, this mara of laziness that tells us that we've already done that bit, we don't need to do that anymore. This mara of laziness that tells us we don't need the meditation object anymore. The mind's so peaceful, the meditation object's just a disturbance. This is mara. And when that happens in your mind, what do? You say, I know you, mara. You're mara, the evil one, come to make me fall away from samadhi. So you keep on going with that breath, lifting the mind on, lifting the mind on, lifting the mind on. Patiently and effortfully, keeping that going with that persistence on and on and on and on. Now if you can only do that in your meditation setting, that's okay. Just do that. There's nothing wrong with that. Okay, so just keep on persistently putting your mind with the breath until we start to feel that it's becoming more flowing. You start to feel it's becoming more natural, that the mind wants to stay with the breath. And that in between breaths, that it's not drifting off so much. Okay? Now, it's not that you reach kind of that stage where you feel that you get that bit of flow with the breath and then you immediately stop that effort of just putting the mind on the breath. That's mara of laziness. You keep on going, keep on going, keep on going until that feels quite definite and confident that the mind is with the breath, clearly each time coming in, each time going out. Now then we start to emphasize the second of the jhana factors that we call vichara. And vichara here is glossed quite nicely in the Abhidhamma on that, and it glosses it as anusandhanata. Anu means along with or sustained. Sandha is a connection. Okay? So anusandhanata is vichara, or anupekhanata is also the translation, is like sustained observation or sustained application. And so this is where we're starting to move to the third stage of breath meditation, where you're watching the whole breath coming in and out, the whole breath coming in, the whole breath going out, and where you're sustaining that observation. So that doesn't mean you've got just, you know, when you're first doing it, you'd be happy if you get just a bit of the breath and the mind might wander off a little bit. That's okay, then you put it back again, and then it might wander a little bit and you put it back on the next one. Now, we're not just going to be happy with just watching a bit of the breath, but we're going to watch the whole breath, right from the beginning through to the end, and then the whole out-breath of right from the beginning to the end. And so, here you still want to clearly define what is the beginning, the middle, and the end of the breath. You clearly define that moment when you start to breathe in. You know exactly when you're starting to breathe in. And you follow that, you follow the texture of that, the feel of that flow all the way through. You notice, what's that texture? Is that rough? Is that smooth? You see that, you're watching that all the way through. You're not thinking about it, but you're just seeing that until it comes to the end, and you know that very moment when you stop breathing in. And then there's a short gap. That's very important, that short gap. Sustain the observation there, and then starting to come out again. And again, you know exactly that point when the breath's starting to come out. You know exactly what it's like all the way through, and you know exactly what it's like right at the end of that breath. Hold your awareness there, and then bring it back in again. So this is this stage of breath meditation, which is like the third step. Now what's happening here is that the mind has started to lose its interest in all of those other things. It started to be tamed. It started to be directed. It started to be more happy, more content to sit down here with the breath and not having to feel like it's going to go wandering off here and there and doing all kinds of things in the meantime. And so we keep on doing that. We keep on focusing on that. Sustained all the way in, sustained all the way out. Not just for one breath or two breaths. You try to do it as long as you can. Try to do it as long as you can. There's an art to it. And so, you know, in a sense, we have to learn to, like, appreciate that art. You know, it's like something, if you've ever learnt any skill, then there's a pleasure in that, isn't there? If you've ever learnt to use a tool to do carpentry, then there's a pleasure in doing good work. If you've ever learnt to do cooking, then there's a pleasure in using that skill you've got of cooking, making delicious food. If you've played an instrument, then there's a pleasure you use in having that art of doing that, or whatever it may be. And so we develop that same pleasure, that same interest in the art of breath meditation. It's a very, very refined skill. As you know, before I was a monk, I was a musician. I played guitar for many years. And I played it for, I don't know how many years I played. 15 years or something like that. And I was quite dedicated. I practiced every day, and I could play just about any style of music that I wanted to. And by the time I finished and gave it up, and you know, I'd learnt, just, you know, gone to different guitar teachers, and they all taught me everything they knew, and they said, we haven't got anything more to teach you. I couldn't find anyone to teach me anything else. And so you get to this point where, you know, your craft becomes quite refined and quite subtle. You can do, you know, so many things. But, you know, having done that and having done breath meditation, you realize how much more subtle that breath meditation is. It's far, incomparably more subtle, more refined than playing the most, you know, subtle classical music might be. So much more subtle. And so when we're watching, doing this stage of sustaining that breath in and out, we're starting to get to that realm where the mind and the body are actually getting unified, getting subtle. Notice that there's this kind of movement towards unity, this movement towards wholeness. Watching that coming in, watching that going out, the mind not traveling around, not wandering, not being interested in other things. And as that keeps going, then naturally your breath again will continue to quieten. So we've already noticed that initial quietening in the first stage where it goes from the long breath to the short breath. But now even that short breath will become much, much more subtle. So very, very soft and silky that you hardly be able to see it at all. This is like the third stage in breath meditation. It's tranquilizing the breath. So the fourth stage, tranquilizing the breath. Now, actually that, you know, that full tranquilization of the breath doesn't, you know, is going on right from the start of practice right through till fourth jhana when the breath disappears altogether. So this is like a long process. But at this stage, you'll notice that there's this, you know, there's this quite definite time when the breath is getting so very, very soft. And it will start to almost disappear. Many people have that experience where they're watching the breath and, you know, they just can't see it anymore. What do you do? So, you know, the worst thing you can do then is to just take a nice deep breath and think, oh, okay, there it is, good, I can see the breath again. Okay? Often what you'll find when the breath disappears like that is a fear will come up. It might be subtle, it might be very strong. But you get like a fear. Fear, of course, is the fear of death. Because, you know, we think that we've stopped breathing. And we think we're going to die. So I don't really know anybody who's actually died while they're sitting in meditation. Usually you know enough to start breathing when you need to. But there's a combination of things happening here. One thing is, of course, that as your body gets tranquil, as your mind gets tranquil, your brain gets tranquil, then you don't need so much oxygen, so that the lungs are not working very hard. And there's this balance in the meditation, this balance between, like, I guess, brightness and clarity and tranquility, the balance between energy and peace. And at this stage, we're emphasizing the peacefulness of the mind a lot, and the mind is becoming very peaceful, so sometimes that balance goes a little bit out of kilter. And the peacefulness gets too much for the brightness or clarity. When that happens, then we're not aware of the breath anymore. Of course, if it happens badly, if it happens seriously, then of course we start nodding and we fall asleep. And it's at this stage that that's very likely to happen. It's almost like there's this fork that we reach. We don't quite realize it. But we make a choice whether our mind's going to be mindful or whether we're going to go down that road of falling asleep, falling into Never Never Land. What they call it different names. In the Thai tradition, they usually call it Bhavanga or Moha Samadhi. And you go in there and you can be very peaceful. You can stay there for a long time and just sit with just equanimity, be perfectly peaceful and still, but you never know anything, you never develop any wisdom. And so, unfortunately, the problem is that you usually go down that road before you've realized it. You're already past the fork, and once you've passed the fork, it's very difficult to get back. So you have to learn to notice the signposts before that. If it is a problem for you, it's not a problem for everyone. If it is a problem for you, you have to learn to notice those signposts. So what that means is, if you know at this stage when your breath is becoming very tranquil, that you're going to tend to go off towards sleepiness, what you need to do is just almost take a step backward, but very, very gently, very delicately take a step backwards and start reapplying your mind with a little bit more effort onto the breath. Not enough to disturb your mind, not shaking your mind up, just that little bit more effort, trying a little bit harder and keep on trying, a bit more clarity, bring that little bit more definition a little bit more definition, watching the breath, and then hopefully that will be able to help you to avoid falling into that trap of bhavanga. If you can be patient with this stage, with that tranquilizing, then if you can have a lot of contentment with that, then you'll notice that gradually, in its own good time, there will come like a sense of rapture, a sense of uplift. This, of course, is the beginnings of the jhana factor of rapture. Now, that experience is something which is quite different for different people, and also quite different in different meditations. In metta meditation, then it's relatively very easy to get a lot of rapture going. Also, for example, in buddhanusati, recollection of the Buddha, and at some other meditations, it's very easy to get rapture. It's so joyful, you can make your mind very, very happy, very easily. Mudita is another one, that's also very good, it's appreciative joy. You do this meditation, and that will give you rise to a lot of rapture very easily. But breath meditation is not one of those. In breath meditation, relatively speaking, it's a bit difficult to give rise to rapture. I don't say necessarily it's hard, but because you go into that very deep equanimity and tranquility, then it tends to take a long time for rapture to arise. And so this is one difference between breath meditation and metta, is that in metta, you tend to get the rapture first and the tranquility later. And in breath meditation, it tends to be the other way around. You get the tranquility first and then the rapture later. So if you find that you're getting to this stage of tranquility, mind's becoming very peaceful in that, but you're not getting the rapture, then, you know, and if that happens once or twice, then never mind, you just keep going. But if you find that happens repeatedly, and that there's a sense of like a lack of spark to your meditation, then maybe you need to try to do something to develop that. For me, the key to that was simply doing a lot of metta meditation. And as I did metta, I found it very easy to develop rapture. And then I learned how to apply that rapture also to the breath. And I remember very clearly, I've got the image exactly in my mind now, where I was sitting at the waterfall at Daodam in my novice year. And that was exactly the moment when I first realized that I could do that. And that, like, these memories sometimes of these experiences in meditation stay with you very clearly. And I can remember the first time I was able to actually watch the breath and just like turn on that sense of rapture with it. And I was quite amazed. It was something I never conceived possible. But there, once you learn the trick, it's like this trick of perception, then it's actually not so difficult. It's not, certainly not an uttari manusa dhamma. It's not a superhuman state or anything like that. It's just a trick of the mind, a trick of perception, to be able to look on that positive side, that joyful side of the breath. Now, this rapture happens in many different ways. Sometimes it's very violent. You'll find that you have like a jerk go through your body, like an electric shock. Sometimes you feel like lightning going down your spine. Sometimes your arms and legs might fly out. Maybe you'll start crying or laughing. Maybe you feel like tingling all over your body. Maybe like pins and needles. Maybe you feel like your whole body's blowing up like the Michelin Man. Maybe you feel very heavy, sitting there like you're a sandstone statue. Or maybe you feel like you're very light and you're about to float away. All of these are just the symptoms of rapture. They're not important in and of themselves. So don't give too much attention to these things. Just enjoy them while they're there. That's what they're there for. They're just there to be enjoyed, to uplift your mind, make your meditation, give a bit of spark to your meditation, that's all. And when they happen, just let them go and keep on coming back to that breath. Keep on coming back to the breath. Keep on coming back to the breath. Keep on coming back to the breath. Don't get caught up in these feelings of rapture. Actually, the rapture which is useful, the rapture which is beneficial for you, is the one that comes up inside the breath. And that means there's no duality there. It's not like the breath is in one place and the rapture is somewhere else, but that the breath becomes rapturous. Now, as this is starting to happen, as you start to get this kind of rapture, and this, what we call, this is pervasive rapture, they call Paranapiti. And this pervasive one is the one that's very important. Now, there's kind of two ways of describing this, or two ways of looking at it, which is one of these things. It sounds like they're different, but really they're not in experience. One way of doing it is to emphasize like the broadness of this. And so this kind of experience, you feel this experience in your body, like the rapture and the breath, you feel sort of pervading your whole body, saturating the body, so that your awareness is quite broad and expansive. The other way of talking about it or looking at it is quite focused and precise, so that you're just watching that small spot of where the breath is, and you're feeling the rapture and so on inside that spot. These are two different ways of looking at it, but they're not really contradictory. They're just different ways of perceiving it. Another way of looking at this is to see that each of these ways of looking at it, which you might hear emphasized by different meditation teachers, but each of these ways is in a sense like a counter medicine for a particular kind of fault. So, you know, if you're watching your breath and if you get too intent on it, too pushing too hard, too tight about your breath, okay, then you're too narrow and you need to relax and make your mind broad and the focus, make your focus broader. But on the other hand, if your focus is just, you're very relaxed and very open, and then you tend to get drifting and waffly, and the mind is just kind of woofle, 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 like a kind of cloud, and it doesn't have any focus and definition. So that's when you need to concentrate on the focus. So, you know, there are different meditation teachers that describe these experiences differently, but please don't see this as a contradiction. It's like, use that as an aid for your practice. Which way of looking at it is actually useful for me now? That's the important thing. And so you have this pervasive rapture, and that pervasive rapture lasts a long time. It's not something which just comes and goes like a thrill. It's a sustained feeling. It's a sustained feeling of uplift, of joy, of brightness. It gives a zest to your meditation. Now, when you're going into this space, then you're starting to realize the extraordinariness of the breath. You're starting to realize that this thing which I've been ignoring my whole life, now as I watch it, it's beginning to change itself just because I'm looking at it. It's beginning to turn into something wonderful. It's beginning to turn into something marvelous. And so you keep on doing that. You keep on watching the breath. Don't lose sight of the breath when this rapture comes. Remember what I said before, that the rapture you really want, the pervasive rapture, is the rapture that's inside the breath. It's not something separate. It's not like you watch your breath at your nose tip and then you get a feeling of rapture coming up your belly. This is not it. Or at least that's not complete yet. The rapture that you really want is that rapture that's in the breath. And so as the mind is going further in, further in, further in, and then the clarity and the precision of that knowing will become greater. What you'll find as that starts to happen is that the breath, the physical breath, the physical sensation of the breath is starting to recede. Those qualities which we noticed when we first were watching the breath, that physical feeling of the air moving, are starting to become secondary. And those other qualities of rapture and light are starting to become more predominant. And that process is continuing. But don't be in a hurry to push that process along. Stay with that physical feeling of the breath as long as you can. Now, as this process continues, that rapture, that feeling of uplift, will gradually refine itself. And then this is going more to the side of what we call sukha. Now, in a sense, like rapture is like the uplift, and sukha, so piti is like the uplift, sukha is like the settling, and sukha is very close to tranquility in its meaning. It's like a saturated contentment of pleasure. It's like a chocolate cake which is soaked through with brandy. And that brandy or that liqueur which is soaking through the chocolate cake. And this is the sukha. And again, that sukha is felt with the breath, in the breath, not something separate. And of course, that sukha is not something separate from the piti, from the rapture, of course. It's the same thing, but a refined version of it. So it's not like it's a separate, it's not an experience, it's like a separate thing. Although you can notice the different tones, but they're still there together. It's not like you have one thing and then you have the other, but that they're working, coming into balance. Now, as this is happening, then at a certain stage, you'll experience what we call a nimitta. And nimitta means a sign. The word nimitta, of course, means sign. And it's a sign of meditation. It's a sign that your mind is approaching samadhi. It's a sign that the mind is becoming pure. You can also think of the nimitta here as being like a reflection. The reflection of the mind. And so as awareness is becoming purified and still, then it starts to see itself. It starts to develop its own self-image. And that image is one of radiance and purity. So as this nimitta comes, then, of course, you know, as the mind is becoming concentrated and these factors are there, then you tend to get many nimittas will arise, which are like fake nimittas, they're not real ones. But they'll be very distracting for you, they'll be very exciting. And they're just another kind of mara that we meet along the road. Remember we were talking the other day about this Zen koan, if you meet the Buddha on the road, kill him. Of course, why do you kill the Buddha if you meet him on the road? Because the Buddha isn't on the road. The Buddha has already walked the road and he's sitting at the end of the road. Whatever you meet on the road, it's not the Buddha. Okay? So this is what that saying means, is when you're practicing this meditation, as you see these nimittas coming up, they're saying, I'm the Buddha, you say, bang, kill them. Get out of here. Ignore them. That'll be very tempting, but as soon as you start to watch that, the mind starts to be distracted. What you'll see is that these kinds of nimittas, these lights, will come up as something a little bit different to the breath. And so it's like your attention is pulled away from the breath towards these things. And so, of course, there's still a diversity there, isn't there? It's not unified. So you just ignore those things and come back to the breath. And like you have to like almost make yourself keep on finding that physical feeling of the breath. You want to just indulge in the feeling of bliss and sukha, but don't do it. You want to just watch those lovely lights that are playing around, but don't do it. These are all just maras. Try and find that breath, even though it's still very difficult. As it becomes more and more subtle, to find that physical breath becomes quite a task. It's become so overshadowed with the feelings of rapture and so on that that's all you can see, and you can't actually see the physical breath anymore. But you need to keep on looking for that and finding that, being grounded on that physical sensation. That's the cause. All this other stuff is the effect. Don't mistake the effect for the cause. Don't just coast along on the pleasant feelings. Okay? It's a big mistake that meditators make, is they coast on pleasant feelings, not understanding that those pleasant feelings are the result. The cause is watching the breath. So as long as you can, you keep on watching, keep on watching, keep on watching that breath. The nimittas will come up more and more powerfully. And they'll come up and they'll say, yes, now I'm the real nimitta, I'm the real thing. And they'll keep on trying to convince you of this, and you just ignore them. Keep on ignoring them, keep on ignoring them, keep on ignoring them. When the real nimitta does come up, it's what we call the technical term is the pratibhaga nimitta, and this is something that's very, very powerful. And it will, you know, outshine those previous nimittas like like the full moon outshines a firefly. And it appears in the mind with a sense of confidence and certainty. It might look like different kinds of things, and people experience nimittas in different ways, like they might experience a nimitta as like a sensation of mist, especially like the early nimittas might seem like a mist or something like that, a bit vague and so on. And the real nimitta, when it comes, it might be quite clearly defined, like the moon or the sun, or it might be just like a general sense of light, like walking into a very bright place and a kind of a light that's appeared that's very strong. Maybe there are different ways that it will appear. Don't worry about it. I even heard Ajahn Brahm describe one time that one meditator on the retreat told him that they had a black nimitta, the most beautiful silky blackness that they'd ever seen in their life. I thought, wow, that's cool, black nimitta. I could do with one of them. So it can be anything. It can even be like a feeling. It doesn't have to be visual. Usually the anapanasati nimitta is visual. It's like a light. Usually the metta nimitta is like a feeling of rapture and joy. But that's just a tendency. It doesn't matter. The nimitta, as it says in the Visuddhimagga, the nimitta is sanyaja, is born of perception. It's not anything. It's just the way you're seeing the breath. It's the way you're seeing the mind. It's the way that this experience is interpreted to itself. In a sense, you can think of the nimitta as being a metaphor. The mind always works by understanding things by metaphor. So when we think of like clarity in the mind, we say, oh, you know, you became enlightened, or oh yeah, the lights have gone on. You illustrate that if you're drawing a cartoon, and somebody who understands something, you draw a little light bulb above their head. And so we have this metaphor in our mind that clarity in seeing and awareness is represented by a light. And so when that happens in our mind, that's how the mind represents it to us. That's all. There's no actual light there. But the mind interprets it and represents it as a light. So that light is very powerful. It's very overwhelming when you first experience that nimitta. It will be something which will change your life. It's something which when you look upon it, you would understand that if you are a Christian and this experience happened to you, you would say, I have seen the face of God. You wouldn't have any doubt about that. And this is like how it's described. It's like when Brahma appears, that the nimitta appears, the light appears. So what you're seeing is the mind which has this power, which in fact is the power of God. It's like that. It actually is. This is the power that the great, the mighty devas get their power from, the Brahma gods. From seeing these lights, this experience. So this is the experience that we call of upachara samadhi. And upachara means threshold. And it's a very strange kind of state. Now, upachara, they often translate it as access samadhi, but access, I think, to me, gives the wrong impression. Like if we think of this cave, well, the access road to this cave is this track which comes from the house. Well, that track goes for a kilometre to the house. And, you know, we're on the access when we get on that road. Well, that's not what upachara samadhi means. It doesn't mean we're a kilometre away from the house. The upachara, in building terms, in Pali, an upachara is like your front porch. So the upachara for this cave is not that road which leads all the way back to the house. The upachara for this cave is that front entrance there, where just outside the curtain. That's the upachara for this cave. So when we have upachara samadhi, then this is like on the threshold of jhana. That means that basically we're there. We're right there. We're right looking into it. And so we can think that it's another way of thinking of this nimitta is like, you know, we're in a place of darkness and we're standing on the doorstep and somebody's just opened the door to a room that's lit and full of light. And we're literally standing on that doorstep and we just have to take one step and we're in. But that step is very difficult to take. In fact, you can't take it. If you try to step in, then of course the door will be shut. And so at this stage is where those different things that the Buddha talks about, and with the Anuruddhas in the Upakilesa Sutta, where he talks about, you know, lights and visions of form. I had light and visions of form, which is the nimitta, and then all these different things arose and the lights vanished. Like sometimes maybe restlessness arose, or else laziness arose, or like squeezing too tight. You squeeze on the nimitta too tight, or you're holding it too loosely, get a bit vague about it. All of these kinds of imperfections of your meditation at this stage. So you're approaching very close to what we call one-pointedness, and this whole, you know, procedure from the beginning, we've gradually been concentrating the mind, coming closer to one-pointedness, and then you're just starting to achieve that at this point. So notice the different ways or different aspects that we can look at this one-pointedness. One of them is that there's no distinction between the breath and the nimitta. I mentioned before, like, you know, you're coming into it as the preliminary nimittas arise, and then there's like one thing is the breath, the other thing is the nimitta. Well, that's not happening anymore. The breath has like completely transformed, and that nimitta has like come up inside it and completely replaced it. That's all there is. It's not breath is one thing, the nimitta is another. So there's like unity in that way. There's also a unity in time. And that nimitta is very, very solid and sustained. It stays steady for a long period of time. It doesn't change. So there's a unity in that way. There's also a unity in a sense of balance, in the sense that all of those other factors, I mentioned those other jhana factors that we've been developing, the vitaka, the applied, the application of mind, the vichara, sustained application, piti, the rapture, the sukha, bliss or pleasure, and the last one, ekagata, the one-pointedness. And so the balance of all of those things also is another meaning of one-pointedness, that they're neither too much nor too little. Okay, so all of those things are still there, and they're all working together effortlessly without even thinking about it. Whereas previously we might have had to be, you know, shuffling a bit, modifying a bit, you know, adjusting a little bit here and there. And now we're certainly not doing that anymore. There's just these things come together. And the other aspect, or another aspect of unification, of course, is that there's not the sense activity. You know, at this stage of upachara samadhi, you can still have a little bit of sense activity. Like you can still have a little bit of hearing and so on. You can still feel things in your body. But you probably wouldn't. Like if you kind of, yeah, well, yeah, okay, it's still there, kinda. But you're so focused and so absorbed into that feeling of brightness that the five senses have almost completely disappeared. They've almost become irrelevant. And you can see how, you know, by going deeper, then they'll disappear completely. And also there's no diversity. Another aspect of one-pointedness, there's no like diversity of object. So you're not thinking of things. Yeah, again, you can still have a thought. Okay, it's not completely one-pointed yet. So yeah, you can still have a thought might come up. But, you know, it'll go away quickly enough. Your mindfulness might drop just for a little bit and the thought comes up and then it'll go away. So all these things, you're very, very close to that kind of balance of one-pointedness. And there's nothing you can do at that stage. It can happen that you can reach a stage like that and just stay there for a long time. Maybe that will happen many times. You'll come back and just sit there and that will happen many times. It might happen dozens of times, hundreds of times. And you don't go any deeper. But at a certain stage, then your mind will want to coalesce. Well, I can't say want. Your mind will, it will just happen. There'll be this coalescence, this coming together, which we call samadhi. It's very difficult to talk about this or to try to describe it. It's just something which is sort of going beyond the realms of, you know, ordinary experience. People can experience it in different ways. Like some people talk about it like dropping down a well as if they're just falling down this well, vroom, and going into it. But other people, for other people, it might be like almost, it's almost like a birthing experience. It's almost like you feel like being sucked down, very kind of in a very strange way, like sucked through a tunnel, like you're being sucked out of a womb or being perhaps sucked into one. Different ways that can be experienced. Again, these aren't important. They're just perception. It's just the way that your mind represents it to you. It's the way you interpret it. It's not the essence of it. But it'll be something will happen at a definite time. You know, there are these signposts, like the arising of the nimitta, the Patibhaga nimitta. It happens at a certain point in time. It's not there, and then zoom, it comes and it's there. It only takes a second or two, and it's in your mind. And the same thing with this point, and the mind will decide that it wants to go into jhana. And it's almost as if, like, each stage that we've been practicing, there's like a cessation, an ending of some kind of sankharas or activities. And so at each stage we're focusing and sustaining our awareness, and there's some kind of sankharas, some kind of activities which is coming to an end. And so you go more and more and more peaceful. But the interesting thing is you don't notice, very often you don't notice what those activities are. That restlessness, those energies, you don't notice what they are until they end. And so at each stage as you go along, you think that you're peaceful. And it's not until those sankharas, which are the coarse ones at that level, disappear, that you go to another level and you think, oh no, now I'm peaceful. What I thought before was peaceful wasn't really all that peaceful, but what I found now is actually really peaceful. And then you go on a little bit further, and then the mind will drop down to another level, and you think, oh no, actually, that previous level, that wasn't really peaceful, but now it's peaceful. So this is like a cycle which keeps going through your meditation. And the same thing happens here. When you've had that nimitta, it's very stable, it's very peaceful, it's very joyous. And, you know, it seems like it's very still. It's probably the most still experience you've ever had in your life. And yet, somehow in that nimitta, the sankharas just stop, the activities which you hadn't even seen, you had no idea that they were there, but somehow in there at some subtle level there were these things that were still moving, and then they stop. And then when they stop, there's like this kind of automatic movement of the mind as it goes into this state of samadhi or jhana. You can't control it. If you try to control it, then you'll destroy it. So usually what happens there is that people get excited and try to go in which case that's it, it's a finish. You get up and have a cup of tea. Or you get scared and you try to pull back, in which case you finish and you get up and have a cup of tea. Well, you don't actually have to get up and have a cup of tea, you can keep on meditating, but it's unlikely that if that happens, if your mind sort of goes towards convergence and then recoils or steps back from it, it's unlikely that you'll go back there again in the same sitting. It might happen, but it's not so likely. Usually it's enough to disturb the mind. So there's not much you can do about this except be patient. And just be patient, be patient, be patient, be patient. Again, at every stage of your meditation, you're going to have to deal with this. That's a subtle sense of restlessness. When you first sit to meditate, you want to make the mind peaceful, you want to be with the breath, and there's a subtle restlessness to that. In each stage, that restlessness will be there, and it will be an obstruction to you getting to the next stage. Even the anagami still has this restlessness, okay? So even an anagami still has that subtle wanting to progress to that next level in their Dhamma practice. Only for the arahants completely got beyond this. And so as our meditation becomes deeper and deeper and more clear and more clear, the mind becomes more and more powerful, and that restlessness also will become much more subtle but also much more powerful. And here at Upachara Samadhi, then at that borderline into jhana, then the restlessness will come up very powerfully. And also the fear will come up very powerfully, because you're leaving everything that you've ever known. This is like the end of the world. This is much more radical than just going to a different country. It's much more radical than changing your religion or moving your house. This is leaving your five senses behind. Think about it. Seeing, smelling, tasting, touching, hearing, all you've ever known, your whole world, you're leaving that now, and you're going somewhere where you've never been, at least not in this lifetime. So it's quite terrifying. And so, again, this is something which meditators quite often describe as these senses of fear at this point. Maybe the heart starts pounding, boom, 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 boom. And then you have to kind of draw back from the threshold and then have to start again and making your mind peaceful. So these things are all very normal, they're very natural. Don't worry about them. Just be patient. Just keep on doing. Keep on going back into that place. Keep on developing it. And keep on trusting that path. If you can get to these levels, then you're doing very well. Trust that. And then trust that the Dhamma has treated you well so far. And it will treat me well from here on. Even though I'm going to unknown territory, I'm not the first one to do this. I'm just going where the Buddha has gone before. I'm just going on the Eightfold Path. And so this is how we like reassure ourselves. The Buddha's been here before. Ajahn Chah has been here before. The great disciples have all been here before. Don't worry, there's nothing to be afraid of. So we just reassure ourselves and then keep on going with the practice. So this is, I've been talking for long enough this evening. This is my talk for you all on doing breath meditation. So may you all develop the breath meditation and have success in your practice. So I'd like to open if there's any comments or questions. Yeah. What do you do if you have that subtle feeling of the breath and then the very coarse feelings in the body? Again, you know, it's just something which you have to deal with, and ultimately you're going to have to develop, like, there's a certain strength of the mind to simply ignore those feelings. But of course, that, you know, there's a difference between normal, you know, pains and aches and things like that, and then very intense ones. Obviously, if it's very intense, then you can't do it. There are some things you can do in breath meditation. You can, like, take that sensation of the breath and then wash through the sensations, the painful sensations. So you just, you know, take that feeling and then just gently wash through the painful feelings, and then sometimes that can help to ease that pain. Ajahn Brahm's solution, and he said his solution to painful feelings in the body is just get into jhanas quickly before your body starts hurting. Typical Ajahn Brahm, very practical for some. If it's a persistent problem, then, you know, you need to look at something physical, changing the way that you're sitting, or maybe doing some yoga before you practice or something like that. But again, ultimately, it's about, you know, it's about that sense of focus and strength. Another thing that you can do is just if you feel that there's a tug of war in your mind, that you want to watch your breath and then you want to watch the feeling, then just stop. Okay, I'm not gonna watch the breath for now. Let my mind watch whatever it wants. Just relax. And then if you want to look at that feeling, you look at the feeling for a while and then just watch it. And then after a while, it begins to kind of not be so intense or so demanding. Yeah, it's just, oh, okay. It's almost like it's like a little kid which is crying, wants attention. And so you watch it. Oh yeah, okay, there. It'll be right. And then after a while, it is just a feeling after all. It's not like a big child eating yucca which is going to come and bite my head off or anything like that. It's just a feeling. And so just sometimes getting to know it is good. And you know, just develop compassion for it. Strong desire to get into jhanas. Oh, just contemplate yourself. Ah, oh, it's only a jhana. Just have to practice contentment. You say, well, what is this? Yeah? What is this now? just focus on the reality that's actually happening. If it's a problem, you can use some reflections. You say to yourself, well, how do you get into jhana? Do you get into jhana by wanting to? How did all the great arahants get into jhanas? Did they get into jhanas by thinking, oh, I really want to get into jhanas? Or did they get into jhanas by letting go? So sometimes just reflecting like that is good. Okay, let's finish my paying mistakes.
Bhagavato Sāvaka Sambhu Sambhu.